One-third of the world's population is thought to have been infected with tuberculosis, with new infections occurring at a rate of about 1 per second. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, how TB and other diseases are becoming resistant to antibiotics. We'll talk with researchers from Iowa State University who are investigating a certain strain of tuberculosis that is multi-drug antibiotic resistant. Then we'll talk about antibiotic use in the U.S. more generally and how antibiotic-resistant bacteria are a growing cause of concern. That's all coming up. First, a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we focus on antibiotic resistance. Perhaps you've heard about that as a growing concern. And this first half hour in particular, with a focus on tuberculosis. One-third of the world's population is thought to have been infected with the dominant strain of tuberculosis, with new infections occurring at a rate of about 1 per second. And the distribution of tuberculosis is not uniform across the globe. About 80% of the population in many Asian and African countries test positive in tuberculin tests, while only 5% of the population right here in the U.S. test positive. In a few minutes, we'll talk with researchers from Iowa State University who are investigating a certain strain of tuberculosis that is multi-drug antibiotic resistant. Then later in the hour, we'll talk about antibiotic use in the U.S. more generally, how antibiotic-resistant bacteria are a growing cause of concern. First of all, joining us, Patricia Quinlisk, medical epidemiologist at the Iowa Department of Public Health. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Let's talk specifically about tuberculosis. You know, we often connect tuberculosis with a bygone era. So in reviewing the statistics today, I was surprised when you see how present it is in the world. Tell us, what is TB? How is it spread?
Well, TB is a bacterial infection, primarily of the lungs, and basically it's spread from one person to another by the person with TB coughing. Now, I'll just tell you, it's hard to spread it. It doesn't spread as easily as things like influenza, but that's basically how it's spread.
Mm-hmm. So one-third of the world's population is thought to be infected. What does that mean, that they're exhibiting symptoms, that they all know they have it?
Well, the good news is that human beings are actually pretty resistant to tuberculosis. So even if you get exposed to TB and even if you get some of the bacteria in your lungs and they start to grow, chances are your body's immune system will take care of it and you'll never get sick. Most people who have been exposed will never get sick. Probably 90% of people who are exposed will never get sick. However, it's a little bit hard to know who's going to get sick and who isn't. So one of the things that we want to do is identify the people who have been exposed to TB and put them on antibiotics to basically ensure that they'll never get sick.
Mm-hmm. How do you determine who's been exposed to TB?
Well, the way we used to do it was a TB skin test. People probably remember this, where they'd do the inner part of your arm and put a little bubble of stuff underneath your skin and then see if your body reacts to that or not by having a hard red lump. Today we still do that, but we also have some other ways. There's some blood tests that we can do today also.
When we look at Iowa, the U.S. and Iowa specifically, how present is TB?
Well, we're very fortunate here in Iowa. You know, about 100 years ago here in Iowa, TB was the number one cause of death. Today, we have basically only somewhere around 30 or 40 cases each year here in Iowa. So you can imagine the very precipitous decrease we've had in TB. And that's come around by a number of different things, us understanding how TB is spread and preventing that, and then, of course, having antibiotics that work against TB to make sure that people either never get TB in the first place after they've been exposed, or if they've got TB, make sure that we treat them very quickly so they don't spread it.
Mm-hmm. 30 to 40 cases, you say, in the state. These are new cases every year?
Right, somewhere around then. Last year, for example, we had 40 cases.
Mm-hmm. So how would these people, these 30 or 40 cases, how would these people get infected?
Well, it sort of varies. if you would say to me, you know, my great uncle Joe just found out he had TB, I'd say, well, it could be that he got it from somebody, you know, 30 or 40, 50, 60 years ago he grew up with, or maybe he was in World War II and went to a country where TB was more prevalent. The thing people don't realize is TB can actually hide in the body for decades before it comes out and makes you ill. So some people got exposed a long, long time ago, and it just doesn't come out and show the disease until they get old and their immune systems aren't working very well. But some people will get it even when they're younger, and we've even had babies with TB. Usually that's because they got exposed relatively recently and maybe, you know, got exposed to a high level of the bacteria, and so their immune systems weren't able to get rid of it, and then they came down with active disease.
Can you get the infection by coming in contact with someone who is exhibiting no symptoms, for instance, just a carrier?
There really isn't a carrier state in TB per se. You either have the disease or you may have what we call latent infection, which is you may or may not have the bacteria still in your body because of an exposure, and those are the people that we give what we call preventive antibiotics to, and we give it to them to make sure that they never come down with the disease. But most people who have active infection, in other words, the bacteria is in their body, it's growing, they're going to have symptoms, but not necessarily always in the lungs. You can have it, for example, in your bone. If it's in your bones, then you're not going to spread it to other people.
And once you have the infection, what are the symptoms?
Well, most people will have TB in their lungs, so they'll have things like coughing. If they have it very bad or it's gone on for a long time, they could even be coughing up blood. They may have weight loss that's not explained by them trying to diet or anything. They could have what's called night sweats, in other words, waking up at night and being sweating. And oftentimes they just don't feel very good. So it could be a combination of things, but TB doesn't like all of a sudden show up in one day and you come down with all the symptoms. Usually it's a very gradual kind of onset, and people sometimes will ignore it for a while just thinking, oh, well, I just don't feel good, and right, not realize, no, what you've really got is TB.
A lot of things can make us cough, of course. I suppose to nail this down as having tuberculosis, you need sort of a blood tester.
Right. Well, usually you'll go in and get assessed. And like I said, most people will have pulmonary or lung TB. And then they may do a chest x-ray. And then again, they can do that skin test or blood test, or maybe even have you cough up some sputum into a cup and actually look and see if they can see the TB bacteria in that sputum.
How does Iowa's TB rates compare to the rest of the nation?
Well, again, we're quite lucky. We're very low compared to many parts of the United States, and certainly are very low when compared to the rest of the world. But we still have cases, and since we are living in a world where there is TB in a lot of other countries, we can have TB brought into a place like Iowa from a person who's traveling from another country.
Mm-hmm. What parts of the country, what states are you aware of where they would have higher rates of TB?
Well, typically you're at higher rates of TB where you have higher rates of immigrants or migrants from countries where there's high rates of TB. Just for example, here in Iowa, about two-thirds of all the cases that we have in Iowa right now are people who are not born in the United States. But about one-third are people who are born and raised here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We want to get into talking about antibiotic resistance, specifically a TB resistance to antibiotics. But can you give us an overview, Patricia Quinlisk? First of all, how much of a problem are the strains of TB that are now resistant to antibiotics?
Well, here in Iowa, in the last 13 years or so, we've only had about four cases of what they call multi-drug-resistant TB, and that's TB that's resistant to the two major antibiotics that we use. So again, that's well less than 1% of all of our cases, and that's over about the last 13 years. We had one case in 1999, one case in 2007, one case in 2010, and one case in 2012. So we're very low, and we've never had any cases of that extremely drug-resistant TB that sometimes you hear about in the news.
Mm-hmm. So we've had some super bugs, but not the really super bugs in our state.
Well, I wouldn't even know that I call them super bugs. When I talk about multi-drug resistant, the problem is they're resistant to the two major antibiotics that we use. So we have to use drugs that maybe don't work as well, maybe not work as fast, maybe have more side effects, but they're still effective and we can still treat them and cure them of the TB.
Patricia Quinlisk is the medical epidemiologist at the Iowa Department of Public Health. Hang on, please, Patricia. We want to reach out to our listeners and ask if you have any questions about disease resistance to antibiotics, about tuberculosis. 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook, or you can send us a tweet at IPR Talk. Patricia Quinlis just mentioned the strain of a multi-drug resistant tuberculosis that has emerged in the world. This new strain is completely resistant to antibiotics and therefore untreatable. Joining us now, two researchers at Iowa State University who are working on discovering the reason this strain of tuberculosis is drug resistant. Guru Rao, he is a professor and chair of the Roy J. Carver Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics and Molecular Biology at Iowa State University. Professor, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
I hope I got your name correct.
Absolutely.
And also with Guru Rao is Ed Yu. He's a researcher in that department, associate professor and researcher at Iowa State University, and also a researcher at the U.S. Department of Energy's Ames Laboratory. Ed Yu, welcome to our program.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to let you divvy up the – I'm going to throw out the questions and let you divvy those up since you're in the studio together there. Explain first – why you chose to focus on this specific problem, this new strain of multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis?
Can I just make one thing clear? I'm not directly involved in research with Mycobacterium tuberculosis. I am the chair of the Department of Biochemistry, and I work with structure function of plant proteins. But I'm, as chair, I'm very much interested in overseeing the various activities and programs. So,
okay, Professor Rao, thank you for that clarification. Mm-hmm. Yeah, please go on to talk about this specific strain.
Ed?
Oh, yeah. In our lab, actually, we work on E. coli all the time. They are our friends. They live inside our gut, and then we feel fun about working on that. And then we realized that actually in bacteria, they have one particular, we call it a mechanism that mediating antibiotics resistance. One of the major mechanisms is producing those antibiotic efflux pump in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh.
then, yep.
Mm-hmm. So there's a pump in the bacteria. This is part of the bacteria.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So basically, I mean, bacteria have developed mechanisms to let compounds in, and they have a mechanism to get compounds out. And these pumps are the proteins that allow the bacteria to do that.
Mm-hmm. So when we have a multi-drug resistant type of strain of tuberculosis, what has happened? The bacteria, what recognizes this is a poison to its system and somehow develops the ability to eject it. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. And in many of the bacteria, well, we see the efflux pump, they are very powerful, and then they do it all the time. In Mycobacterium tuberculosis, in TB, that would be a little less obvious in a sense that because TB has a very thick cell wall, and then that disallow the fixed cell wall disallow those antibiotics to come into the system easily. So that is a little fussier for us to tell whether those antibiotics pump kind of like acting really active inside there. But in our lab, we find some evidence about it, and then we are kind of like believing that actually TB, those antibiotics pump is also actively working very importantly in the system.
Mm-hmm. So how do you approach a problem like this? You want to disable the pump or have it not recognize the antibiotic? What is the approach to breaking down the resistance of this particular strain?
So if you visualize the three-dimensional structure of this pump, the pump essentially consists of protein molecules that have assembled together, and this assembly gives them a shape, a three-dimensional structure that allows them to specifically recognize these compounds. And that's what, so the interaction or the ability of that compound to be recognized by the pump is what enables the pump to function.
Okay.
And so this is a unique relationship that exists between the pump and the compound.
So it's not that the pump has changed. It's that the ability for the bacteria to recognize some certain substance has changed.
Yeah, we try to understand how the pump recognize, let's say, antibiotics, and then we can do something about it. Let's say we call it structural-based drug design, and then we are kind of like working on the basic research and trying to understand the mechanism of that. And then let's say the antibiotics binding site and how we find a way to block the pump working and things like that. And that is our essential goal, trying to work on those.
This is very interesting. Thank you for making it understandable for us for me as a non-medical person. But I wonder, Professor Rao, if you can tell us what Professor Yu's work represents when we step back, zoom out to get a big picture of antibiotic resistance and the threat posed by it.
Yeah, so Dr. Ed, you just mentioned about rational drug design. So let me just step back to the shape of the molecule or the shape of the pump. So you can imagine that you have a square hole and you have a round object. Obviously, the round object is not going to fit into a square hole. And so if you look at the three-dimensional structure of a protein and you are able to then recognize specific regions within that three-dimensional structure that interacts with the antibiotic, then that gives you a very good basis for determining what changes you can make in the pump itself that will now enable the bacterium to pump out the antibiotic,
mm-hmm.
or keep the antibiotic in. One of the major problems that you have with multiple drug resistance is basically that there's mutations or changes that occur in the protein that allow this bacterium to become resistant.
What are we doing in our medical practices in the United States or elsewhere in the world that is creating or perhaps accelerating the creation of multi-drug resistant tuberculosis?
Well, we use antibiotics too much. That's one thing. And also, not just antibiotics. Let's say casual household products, let's say tooth, okay. Let's say clean up your tooth and then you have the toothpaste. Actually, toothpaste also, inside there also have some sort of antimicrobial agent. Let's say we call it triclosan. Mm-hmm. And then we find out actually triclosan can induce those antibiotics pump.
So all of our toothpaste, or is that only certain toothpaste then?
That I don't know about.
Okay, and I know a lot of hand soap these days has antibiotics in it too. Is that a contributing factor?
Yeah, I would say.
I think one of the things that we have learned is that there are always going to be strains of bacteria that intrinsically are going to have resistance, and we don't understand why. I mean, even when you look back in history, even before penicillin was discovered, there were already penicillin resistant strains of bacteria. So we really do not understand why there intrinsically is resistance to certain molecules. And one of the most significant things about Professor Ed Yu's work is that it for the first time his work has enabled us to look at the fundamental molecular architecture or structure of a protein that is involved in transport of molecules mm-hmm. across the membrane.
How do you do that? What instrument do you see? Do you use to see at that small of a scale?
I will defer to Dr. Edu. He's the expert.
No, actually, the work is, the technique is, we call it X-ray crystallography. Basically, all materials, you can crystallizing them. After you crystallize them, and then you can put it on the X-ray diffractometer, and then shine an X-ray light on that, and then that will give you a diffraction pattern. And then based on the diffraction pattern, then you will be able to generating the three-dimensional structure of a particular molecule. In our case, that molecule is the pump, the antibiotics pump. And then to do that, then we can be able to see the details of the pump and then how it interacting with antibiotics. And then we can see the antibiotics binding site, let's say, for example. And then from there, we can do something about how to block these pumps work, disallowing this pump to work and things like that.
Just a few minutes ago, Patricia Quinlisk told us that here in Iowa, this is not such a problem, this multi-drug resistant tuberculosis strain. Where in the world do we see this strain evolving?
India.
Why in India?
I really do not know why India has become the one of the major countries for multiple drug-resistant strains. And I wonder if it's also because of the AIDS epidemic as well. I mean, there seems to be a resurgence in Mycobacterium drug-resistant strains after the advent of AIDS.
Hmm.
So it's you probably can think of it as an opportunistic resurgence.
So when people's
immune systems
are compromised or stressed, that's where tuberculosis can enter.
It seems very much the case, yes. And India is one of the major countries, and perhaps even Africa.
Professor Ed Yu, in your analysis, you mentioned that this is this major threat and the challenges of our global prospects for TB control. What would need to happen to make this strain more of a global concern, that we would be more worried about it than we are today?
Let's say more and more of the strain become, we call it XDR, extensively drug resistance, or lately we find out there's another new strain called totally drug resistance TB, we call it TDR. Those are untreatable. TDR TB is untreatable based on our knowledge. So if let's say if you find one of those bacterium surviving in the surrounding, there is a good chance that they will expanding, and then more and more people will get infected, and then by that time then we will have a global challenge.
Aren't there ways to combat tuberculosis strains without antibiotics? Is that the only tool we have?
I don't know the precise answer to that. But if you think about all the different strategies that are being used to treat TB, all of them basically address essential biochemical processes that the bacteria need to survive. So bacteria typically have this cell wall that is composed of molecules called peptidoglycans. And human cells do not have that. So penicillin, in fact, destroys the ability of the bacteria to form the peptidoglycan. So it has a very weak structure as a result of which the bacterium dies. And similarly, the other drugs, the sulfonamides, for instance, target the ability of the bacteria to synthesize folic acid, which is an essential compound for survival.
Okay.
And there are other strategies like that.
We've run out of time. Thank you very much for sharing with us a bit of your expertise, Professor Guru Rao and Professor Ed Yu of the Roy J. Carver Department of Biochemistry, Biophysics, and Molecular Biology at Iowa State University. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, I think, Patricia Quinlisk of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Still there?
Patricia I'm still here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us this half hour. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about antibiotic use in the U.S. more generally, how antibiotic-resistant bacteria are a growing cause of concern. And we'll talk about the causes for that, what you perhaps can do to stem or help stem the problem. Questions you have about disease resistance to antibiotics, 1-866-780-9100. Nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 4 years ago, the first African-American won the presidency. Now, to win the White House in 2012, Barack Obama will once again have to make history. Only Franklin Roosevelt was elected with unemployment this high. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about the mood at the Democratic National Convention and the message Democrats are trying to get out. Politics Wednesday, tomorrow, here over the noon hour on River to River. This hour, we're talking about antibiotic use in the U.S. And this hour, we talked in the first half hour specifically about tuberculosis. This half hour, about tuberculosis as well, but also more generally, how antibiotic-resistant bacteria are a growing cause of concern. And joining us to begin with in that discussion, Mike Pentella. He is a clinical associate professor in the University of Iowa Department of Epidemiology at the College of Public Health, also associate director for disease testing at the State Hygienic Lab in our Iowa City studio. Mike Pentella, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Remind us, many of our listeners have just joined us, of the big picture problem here that we're facing that has to do with antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Well, we're suffering from an increase in antibiotic-resistant organisms. I think almost everyone's probably heard of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, and how it's first started out in hospitals as a hospital-acquired infection and then spread into our communities. And we see people getting community-acquired MRSA as well. So that's been a problem, and now we're seeing other gram-negative organisms like E. coli and Klebsiella pneumoniae developing resistance too and making them extremely difficult to treat. These organisms that become resistant cause more morbidity for the patient. It may take them longer to get well, and in some cases there's a higher mortality rate associated with infections with antibiotic-resistant organisms. And while it takes longer for the person to get better, it may also take more expense to treat them for their infection. So there's treatment challenges with antibiotic-resistant organisms.
Let's talk a little bit about the causes that the reasons that we're getting these antibiotic-resistant bacteria. List some of the contributing factors.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that antibiotics have only been widely used for about the past 70 years. And the organisms have been around for about 3.5 billion years. So when you're looking on the spread of things, and this was mentioned in your first half hour about how why do these organisms develop resistance and do they have intrinsically resistance to some antibiotics to start with, which we do see as well. So they have an opportunity to reproduce about every 15 to 20 minutes. So their generation time is really short. Mm-hmm. And they can acquire means and mechanisms to be resistant on their own. Then there's also the concern about the overuse of antibiotics, as was mentioned in the first half hour. And that can lead to improper use and exposing the organisms to the antibiotics, encouraging them to develop a means to be resistant so that they survive.
So one of the ways in which we encourage antibiotic resistance is, I understand, a common practice, and we've all had this happen where we are prescribed an antibiotic and then, hey, it's a 10-day prescription and after 2 or 3 days we feel actually much, much better, so we stop. What does that do to encourage resistance?
Well, because the antibiotic is there and now a lower level and isn't actively killing the organism and effectively inhibiting it from reproducing, right, then it's able to overcome that antibiotic effect and develop resistant mechanisms and go on and cause a more serious infection. And what we were talking about in the first half hour with TB is a good example of that. Treatment for TB can take up to 6 months of antibiotic therapy. So the person may start to feel better after just a couple months, and then they stop the treatment, and then a few months, a year, or even 2 years later, they again come down with the signs and symptoms of TB, but now the organism is resistant to the antibiotic that they were being treated with before.
So now the physician has the option of going to a different antibiotic.
Yes, there are oftentimes other antibiotics that they can select, except in that case of totally resistant TB.
I understand. Also, one of the problems too is antibiotics used in our livestock production, and Iowa being the ag economy that it is. What can you say about that?
Well, there's a lot of debate about the use of antibiotics in livestock and whether that creates resistance problems or not. I've seen articles in favor of both it being a problem and it not being a problem.
Does the science come down on one side or the other yet, or?
I don't believe it does. I don't see convincing evidence either way that it is a major problem for human infections or not. But it does go to the overall judicial use of antibiotics. And the Ed, you mentioned in the first half hour about antibiotics being in our toothpaste, for example. We live in a world where antibiotics are in all kinds of products. You can buy antibiotics in carpeting. You can buy socks with antibiotics in them. When you think about it, do you really need to put antibiotics in carpeting? Mm-hmm. And really is not going to cut down on infections tremendously, but it is exposing those organisms to the antibiotic and can lead to resistance. So in general, I think we overuse antibiotics. We are using tons of antibiotics in the world every year.
Isn't there some way in helping to tackle this problem that a governmental agency, the FDA, I don't know who it would be, would say, you know, let's do a better job of judging which products, whether that's carpet or socks or toothpaste, where we may put in our antibiotics. Are there moves to do that or to think about doing that?
I think the CDC has made efforts to keep us more informed about antibiotic resistance and educating the public about when antibiotics are appropriate to use.
Okay.
And that's probably the best way is the consumer being informed.
If you'd like to join our conversation, Mike Pentella is Associate Director for Disease Testing at the State Hygienic Lab. He's a microbiologist. We're talking this hour about antibiotic resistance. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Your questions about disease resistance to antibiotics, how that's a growing problem. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. Also joining us now, Jason Newland. He is a pediatrician at Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics in Kansas City. He specializes in pediatric infectious diseases and is director of the Antimicrobial Stewardship Program there. Dr. Newland, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to this conversation. What do you have to add to perhaps a facet of this conversation that we've left out up to this point?
Well, I think the conversation has been great, and Dr. Pentella has highlighted a lot of key points that's out there. And I would just like to reiterate is that, you know, one of the issues that we see is clinicians that prescribe antibiotics when they don't need to. And so not only the example that you provided where the consumer or the patient takes an antibiotic for a couple of days and then doesn't get the rest. Well, there are many instances where we as the providers have provided antibiotics when we don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also have the society where people like to come into the office and say, hey, I've had a runny nose and cough for a week and it's looking all green and nasty. Will you give me an antibiotic? And they'll ask you for the specific antibiotic by name. Saying that you need to give me a fix now, and I think our providers struggle with that is because they know that there's probably somebody else that'll give them the antibiotic.
Right. So they're impatient. We patients are impatient. We want a quick fix, and because of the internet, our digital age, we can inform ourselves very quickly, and then walk in and say, Doc, I need this, and if not, I'll go somewhere else.
Correct.
Mm. Now, the first facet that you mentioned there about the overprescription of drugs by doctors, is this – why do doctors do this? Is it because it makes that appointment that much shorter, or because they are uncertain about what to do? And if you prescribe an antibiotic, well, there's a good chance you'll club it.
I think there's a lot of issues here, and it's a great question and something that we struggle with from where I sit in trying to, you know, have the judicious use of antibiotics used. I think there's a couple things. One is that people like to do what's easiest, the path of least resistance. And sometimes it's easier just to say, hey, here's your antibiotic. I got an easy one. Go take this for 5 days. You'll feel better. I think it does take a little more effort to say to somebody, hey, you know, I know you're feeling crummy and it's been for 5 or 6 days. This is a virus. You do not need an antibiotic. We know that there's problems with resistance. It was brought up before that, you know, MRSA is an issue, and there has been papers that have suggested that there's an association between the use of antibiotics, whether it's antibiotics that don't even work against MRSA, that actually have led to more risk of having MRSA. So there are definite consequences that are out there, and so that's hard to do. And the other thing is, you know, people have been conditioned. They have gone to the doctor, they have gotten an antibiotic, and lo and behold, they got better 2 days later. Whether it was the antibiotic or not, because they'd been sick a week, they've learned to do that. And so I think that's where it makes it really, really difficult, and we have to start bringing out the consequences that we're starting to live with every day in the fact that we're seeing bacteria cause infections that we can't treat with antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned viruses, too. Remind us, because this is an area of great misunderstanding, I imagine. Patients walking in, many of us get mixed up, bacterial infection, viral Correct. Infection. What's the difference? Where can an antibiotic be helpful, and where is it no help?
Right. So an antibiotic will not work against a virus. So the viruses such as influenza, parainfluenza, all these other names that are called viral infections, an antibiotic will not work against. As a matter of fact, we don't have many antivirals or medicines that fight against viruses that work. So it's all tincture of time, so to speak, in supportive care.
Okay. You are a pediatric physician, a pediatrician. Tell me, what are the biggest challenges when you face infectious disease in children? How is that different than in an adult?
You know, I think obviously one of the things in children is that we know kids get a lot of infections. You would probably say 50% of, you know, visits to the clinics and even at our hospitals are related to some kind of infectious disease or etiology, just because, you know, kids are coming into contact with their viruses for the first time, therefore they're getting ill with these, unlike sometimes in adults. I think that sometimes it's thought that, well, maybe the kids or maybe our children in the hospital aren't seeing these resistant infections. And unfortunately, that's not the case. I personally have been in situations where I haven't had an antibiotic that could treat an infection. And that's scary because it is now not just an adult problem, but it's into our children. And I think we have to be mindful that if we continue on the rate, you know, we could lose our antibiotics much quicker than we need to.
Okay, 1-866-780-9100 to speak about your question about antibiotic resistance. Jason Newland is with us, a pediatrician at Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics in Kansas City, and also with us, Mike Pentella. He is the Associate Director for Disease Testing at the State Hygienic Lab, also at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Let's go to Judy on line one. Hi, Judy.
Good morning. My question for your guests is, is antibiotic resistance an individually acquired trait? That is, if I abuse or misuse antibiotics, I become resistant? Or even if I never abuse or misuse antibiotics, can I still become susceptible to resistance because it has become so prevalent in the community or in health facilities where I might be treated?
Great question, Judy. We'll hand that off, I think, to Mike Pentella.
Yes, it's definitely based on the organism itself, not on the patient. So you're acquiring an organism that's developed the ability to resist treatment with the antibiotic. So the antibiotic acts against the microorganism, against the bacterium, whereas the host is fighting it with their own immune response. The antibiotic helps the patient to fight off the infection.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about prevention, unlike, say, lowering your cholesterol, that's something you can do individually.
That's exactly a good example.
This is a different case.
Right. You're acquiring an organism that has learned to be resistant to the antibiotic.
There's a question in an email, a series of questions in an email from Rick, who is listening to our program. The suggestion that the problem in Iowa can be fixed by treating everyone who has been exposed fails to recognize that, Rick writes, one, the course of antibiotics lasts a full year. At Iowa's universities, there are thousands of international students who have been exposed in their home countries, and these students will mostly return home after school and be re-exposed to TB once more, even though they endure the year of a treatment while they're here in Iowa. Several dimensions to that. I wonder if, Mike Pentelli, you can address any of those things.
Well, Rick's potentially right in the fact that if you go back and you're exposed again to the TB organism, you could get reinfected with another strain of tuberculosis. But it's very important to protect others that the person may come in contact with here in Iowa, and also give strengthen their immune response by recovering from the infection so that they're healthier and able to fight off the infection in the future. So it is very important for us to treat those individuals who we detect are infected with TB.
Kevin joining us from Ames. Hi, Kevin. What's on your mind?
Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to sort of amplify the comments that the previous caller had made when she inquired about whether it was the person that had the resistance or it was the bacteria, and that also that, you know, that what I haven't heard in this entire conversation is that this is what we're looking at as an evolutionary process. I mean, we are selecting against, you know, bacterial strains that don't have antibiotic resistance. So we're applying antibiotics, it kills those bacteria, but it leaves individual bacteria that might have native resistance to that bacteria, and then they multiply and spread. And so that's where these antibiotic resistance bacteria come from. I mean, and alternatively, you know, they can acquire resistance, you know, laterally by getting it from another bacterium, since bacteria can exchange little bits of their genetic material, and so they can actually give each other antibiotic resistance. And again, I'm kind of disappointed that none of your guests have ever mentioned that this is an evolutionary process that we're witnessing, and, you know, it seems like people are avoiding that whole element of this problem.
Okay. Kevin, I think we did touch on that, but we can touch on that again. Perhaps Jason Newland, would you like to
Sure.
remind us about what Kevin's mentioning?
No, I think Kevin's absolutely right. I mean, the evolutionary process is definitely in play here. You know, we're treating bacteria with antibiotics. We're putting resistance to make them have to survive. And they're smart, and they can figure out ways. I think Staph aureus is a prime example. You know, if you look back in the history of Staph aureus disease, when we started using penicillin in 1941 to treat the first patients, within a year of that treatment, we had penicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Now, we don't talk about that, and people don't realize that penicillin at one point did that, but that's right, that the evolution's the case, and that if we continue to go on, and I think that's what we're trying to work on, is to say, you know, it's going to continue to evolve, and we're going to continue to use antibiotics, because they're important drugs, and they've been life-saving drugs over the last 70 years. But if we don't use them more appropriately, we are going to be back to what it was like before we had antibiotics. That's the case, and so that's why we have to do more to try to keep these around. I think what we haven't talked about as well is the fact that the antibiotic pipeline that the drug companies have is very, very slim to none for antibiotics, especially against those gram-negative bacteria that were mentioned by Dr. Pentelli at the beginning. Those are the ones that are scary, and there's no future antibiotics at this point in time that we know of that's going to come to the rescue, I would say.
So why is that, despite a push for new antibiotic therapies, a continued decline in the number of newly approved drugs? What's going on there?
Well, if you think about it from a sense of economics, and you say, okay, an antibiotic is a finite. It's a 10-day course. It's a 7-day course. It's not a anti-cholesterol drug where the person's going to be on it probably for their lifetime, or a anti-hypertensive, or, you know, against hypertension medicine that's going to be on for their lifetime. It's finite. Additionally, you have people that are saying, hey, only use it when you're supposed to. So if you think about the amount of money it takes to develop a drug and then put it to market, to go through all the regulations that it takes, it's economically, there hasn't been a lot of value put into that. Now, with that being said, there's a new act that is, I think, made it through Congress called the GAIN Act that's supposed to stimulate and to incentivize drug companies to do this, drug companies to develop new antimicrobials. And that's what we need. And we need that, as well as we need to be addressing the overuse.
We're coming to the end of our hour. I'd like to get Jason Newland and Mike Pentelli your final thoughts here. I guess to pitch it kind of forward into the future, we're talking about a growing problem that we're facing with these antibiotic resistant bacteria. Mike Pentelli, when will we face a real crisis? This is growing. Will we have a tipping point where action really needs to be taken, or else?
Well, I think inevitably we will face that in the future as we look to more antibiotic-resistant organisms developing. But I think we have to take a broader perspective, as Patty Quinlan mentioned in the first part of the half hour. When we looked at TB 100 years ago in Iowa, that was a major cause of mortality in the state. At the turn of the century in the 1900s, we saw TB, pneumonia, and diarrhea being the top causes of death. Today, we're seeing a much different picture, and we've brought things under control with antibiotics and vaccines, and it's important to keep those means available.
Jason Newland, perhaps 20 seconds for you, any concluding remarks you had.
No, I would agree. I would agree with Dr. Patel. He summed it up really well, and I think that brings in the fact that, you know, immunizations are important, and to have the public realize that this is a problem, and that to help us in keeping around our antibiotics will be huge and helpful for everybody.
Jason Newland, Mike Pantella, thank you very much for joining us this half hour.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer, Catherine Perkins, and Emily Woodbury. Caitlin Fry helped us out today. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, help from Jason Burns. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. We always welcome your comments and questions. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org, our email. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.